America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
And greetings, my friends, broadcasting live coast to coast from Los Angeles to New York, from Detroit to Denver to... On and on it goes. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Washington, D.C. at the Take Back America Conference. Ron Pollack is with us. He's the founding director of Families USA, the national organization for healthcare consumers. Their website, familiesusa.org. Hey, Ron, welcome to the program.
Delighted to be with you again.
Great to have you here at the conference. Tell us, what's Families USA up to these days? Go ahead.
Well, the key issue right now before the Congress relates to children's health coverage. There are 9 million children in the country who are uninsured, and the so-called State Children's Health Insurance Program, SCHIP, is up for reauthorization, and it is our hope that when Congress finishes its work on this legislation, they will add sufficient money to the states so that the 9 million children who are uninsured today can gain health coverage.
Now, this is the program that shows up in a lot of states. Like in Vermont, it was called Dr. Dinosaur, Howard Dean's program. There's variations, or is that Medicaid that's being used for children?
It's confusing.
It is.
Well, it's actually a combination of both things. Medicaid is what's used for the lowest income children. This SCHIP program that has all these different names in the different states, like Dr. Dinosaur and so on. Those programs. Are for children and families marginally above the lowest poverty levels. They're for working poor families who are in jobs that can't get health coverage on their own. And so it's essentially for kids with incomes below 200% of the federal poverty level, which is for a family of three, $34,340 in annual income.
One of the things that Michael Moore's new movie is pointing out, and that I think is, it's like America knows about this, but we don't talk about it, is that there is this huge chunk of the middle class, people who are not at or near poverty and are not the very wealthy, but frankly, I'd say people with income from on the low end, $25,000, $30,000 a year, to on the high end, in the low hundreds, you know, $100,000 a year for a family, who, depending on where they're living, I mean, you know, there's some cities in the United States where the cost of living is very high, who are struggling with health care, particularly if they have to get the health care, if they have to buy health insurance themselves, if they don't get it through their employer, or even worse, are fully insured, and yet a sickness wipes them out because of all the copays and all the deductibles and all the games that the health insurance companies play with us. To what extent do programs like this plug the holes for kids in that spectrum?
Well, unfortunately, it only plugs some of the holes. But very importantly, it covers those lower wage families that have children. And some of the states, by the way, go above 200% of poverty. New York is now going up to double that, which is about $68,000-$69,000 of income for a family of three. New Jersey is at 350% of poverty. It doesn't cover every child in the country, potentially, but it covers the overwhelming majority, potentially, of those children who are currently uninsured. Right. Now, if only Congress provides the money to the states, so that the states have the funds to enroll those children, we can make enormous headway.
Families USA, you put on the conference that we were at last year.
That's right, in January.
And in fact, we did this show from. And so, what plans for this year?
We're going to do it again this coming January. By that time, hopefully when you come back, not only will we have completed work on expanding coverage for kids, we can start the bigger job, which is to cover everybody. There are 45 million people in the country who are uninsured. The cost of health insurance is rising much faster than earnings.
Yeah.
Since the year 2000, insurance premiums rose six times faster than earnings. So more and more people are being priced out of health care.
Yeah, and so did the pay of CEOs in the health insurance industry, by the way.
Right.
I mean, that's the thing that that is almost unmentionable. It's so hard to find politicians who are willing to talk about this because they don't want to take on an industry that can squash them like a bug and that passes out huge quantities of money in Washington, D.C. And that is that even people who are insured are at risk.
No question. And the largest source of bankruptcies in the country is health care costs.
Right.
And the overwhelming majority of people who are bankrupt from health care costs actually have insurance.
Right.
But they have to pay deductibles and co-pays. And when you finish with all that, if you have a really expensive illness, you can easily go bankrupt.
Yeah, it is just mind-boggling to me. I know, five, 6 years ago, I have celiac disease, which is a genetic condition that flips on sometimes and as you get older and where you can't digest wheat. And all of a sudden, I just started getting sick and had no idea why. It took like a year to diagnose it, and I went through all these tests and all this nonsense, and finally, actually, Louise tracked it down on the Internet and went back to the doctor and said, do this test. But we had full health insurance that we were buying ourselves. I mean, it was like $1,000 a month for us. And still, I think it was well over $10,000 in deductibles and copays that we had accumulated in the course of that year for all these tests and everything else to try and figure out. Because I'd lost like 30 pounds. I mean, I was dying and couldn't figure out why. And it turned out it was, take wheat out of your diet and everything's fine. That was my real wake-up 5 years ago, 6 years ago, of really how dysfunctional what I thought was a functional healthcare system was. Because I remember growing up as a kid, we had Blue Cross Blue Shield. It was a not-for-profit company. Through my dad worked in a tool and die shop in Michigan, and it covered everything. Covered everything. And it's just a whole different world now.
The average cost, premiums, just premiums, for employer-sponsored health insurance for family coverage is now $12,000 a year. Now, if you're buying coverage on your own, it's much more expensive because you don't get the benefit of economies of scale. And even when you pay that larger amount of money, you have big deductibles. Those deductibles are going up with each passing year and copayments. So increasingly, people who thought health insurance was for some other person, it's an altruistic impulse to help somebody else, people now understand it's in their self-interest for us to have meaningful health reform.
How do we change this?
We've got to have leadership on the top for this. This is not something that can be done by just you and me alone.
Don't you think, though, that at the same time we have to have raising hell at the grassroots?
Absolutely.
I mean, that's what's going to produce the leadership at the top, it seems.
Absolutely. And I think we're seeing that happen. This issue is now the top domestic issue in the nation. It's the second top issue overall. Iraq, of course, is by far the most significant issue in the electorate right now. But healthcare has become the top domestic issue. And I think what's happened, what's really changed this, is that instead of people who care about this doing it out of an impulse of altruism for someone else, they're saying, look, I need this for myself. I need it for my family.
Yeah.
And self-interest is a pretty powerful motivating source.
Well, I think Americans are realizing that they're out of luck if they get sick, whether they have insurance or not. They think, oh, gee, we've saved up enough money for a vacation or something like that. Boom, that's gone in an afternoon.
If you have a major illness and you've got significant deductibles and copays or some limits in your coverage, right, you're in real trouble.
Yeah, yeah. And it shouldn't be that way. I've always suggested, I've always thought that the really... by the way, we're talking with Ron Pollack. He's the founding executive director of Families USA, familiesusa.org, National Association for Healthcare Consumers. And, Ron, it has always seemed to me that really what we need to do is redefine healthcare as a right in the United States rather than a privilege. And, is there any movement to do that you know of?
Well, the effort to do that is to actually make sure that everybody has health coverage and that it's affordable. And that's the key thing. You can't just say to someone, you got to get coverage. If it's unaffordable, you're not going to get coverage. And so this is going to require a number of things. We've got to contain costs where possible. I mean, for example, when Congress and the White House under President Bush passed this prescription drug legislation for seniors, they prohibited Medicare from bargaining for cheaper prices. And so the prices are sky high. We can squeeze those prices and in the process expand coverage for people that don't have it.
Sounds like a plan. Sounds like a plan. Ron Pollack, familiesusa.org, the website. Ron, thanks a lot for being with us here today.
Happy to be with you again, Tom.
Great. Good talking with you. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C., deep in the belly of the beast here. Stick around. We'll be right back.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. Katrina VandeHeuvel is with me. She is the editor of and publisher of The Nation, thenation.com, one of the nation's oldest, since 1865, oldest and best publications of
going strong since 1865.
Indeed. Great to have you with us, Katrina. You're going to be doing a forum tonight or a panel on the new populism. Probably the most famous, quote, populist in America is Pat Buchanan.
Well, one question I want to ask him, I think one of the hidden messages of the 06 election, not hidden to us, but hidden to a lot of inside the Beltway establishment media, was that it was the anti-war and economic populist energy that swept so many Democrats into office in 06. And in some ways it was a deliverance election, also a great retribution. But I'm going to ask them, you know, as you said, populism has historically had an underside. I would say that Lou Dobbs is today the best-known populist. And what do you do when he expends as much passion railing against corporations that outsource jobs as about, quote, illegal aliens who take away America's jobs. So how do you, you know, where is your populism? These are good people. Sherrod Brown of Ohio, whose race was in many ways a signature race in 06. It's a state which gave Bush his electoral victory in 04. And he fought a good race as a man committed to choice, to civil rights, civil liberties, and also fought hard, obviously, against the war and on the populist economic message. Senator Amy Klobuchar from Paul Wellstone State, great progressive senator, and Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont. Unfortunately, Jim Webb of Virginia and John Tester of Montana won't be on it, but I would include them, certainly, in this.
Let's define populism.
I think populism is... It's tricky, but it's a belief that government has a role to play in countering and checking a corporate power that is now run amok. And
not just corporate power. I mean, you know, historically populism has
been... It's about people. It's also about giving people the power to organize their lives and to give them power. The other flip side, though, of it is, particularly in the South, there's a belief that populism is also about government organizing social rights and morality.
Well, there have been populists. I mean, there were populists. You could argue that the pro-slavery movement in some ways was a populist movement. You could argue that certainly the anti-civil rights movement in the South was a populist movement. It's like at a certain level, populism is vulnerable to demagoguery.
No, what's tricky for the for progressives is that progressives believe in also defending minority rights. And I think you get into a majoritarian populism, which loses sight of that. For me, the economic populism that resonates, I hope, today, is one that is defending people's interests.
Right.
Again, I come back to a fact that the social contract, in my view, has been shredded in these last 25, 30 years, maybe longer, right? Where's the countervailing power? Labor is weak, has to get stronger, so that there has to be a role for government. And I'm excited because our cover story next week is about a new survey out by Rick. This is a cover story by Rick Perlstein, who writes about the conservative movement. But it's looking at how the landscape in this country has never been more favorable for a progressive movement, because there's a new belief that government does have a role to play in the economic order, in helping those who can't defend themselves, and I think that's hopeful.
To that extent, we just have a couple of minutes here left. I'm curious your thoughts on, you do a lot of high-profile national media, and my experience in that world, and my experience in having high-profile national figures on this program, is that they just want, they, by and large, they don't want to go into a lot of those topics. And I'm wondering, how do we get a message? How do we get, you know, economic populism, for example, an anti-corporate message, or not anti-corporate, because I'm not anti-corporate.
A shared prosperity, a sense that things are out of whack.
How do we get that through that, you know, you've got these politicians who are afraid to talk about certain topics because they don't want to anger lobbyists and whatnot. You've got media that doesn't want to talk about those issues because the media is owned by giant corporations that are invested in those issues. How do we deal with that?
Well, Tom, you asked me about my experience. I mean, my experience, I hope, will be replicated because I think we need to do several things. One is to get a lot of messengers, electeds, activists, thinkers, onto the mainstream airwaves. Yeah. After all, those airwaves belong to the people. We need to do that. Then we need to make sure we're electing politicians who will speak truth, who know the difference between, as Bill Moyers wrote in our magazine, the difference between a weather vane and a compass. So, and then we need to build up an alternative media, which will hold the electeds and the media accountable, as well as getting out our own message. But I've never checked my integrity at the door. I go on those programs. I bring the message that I write in longer form at The Nation.
No, you do a great job of it.
But it's
But you're not. But
there are not enough of us.
I was going to say, it's like every single day there'll be somebody
20, 30
from
of them.
From the right, and then from the far right, and then from the Reich.
But we need to. Yeah, and I think some of those networks now have also moved right. Curiously,
at the moment
when the country is more progressive, so we need to inundate them. We need to really push it and train. As we at this conference, there's training of electeds, too, to be more progressive.
Indeed. Very well said. Katrina VandenHeuvel, the editor and publisher of The Nation, thenation.com, the website. Katrina, thanks so much
for being with us.
And for the great, great work you're doing.
Thank you.
Keep it up. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio.
Is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Tom Hartman broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C., deep in the belly of the beast here at the Hilton Hotel in downtown Washington, and a wild time it is here. We're on Radio Row, as you can hear, surrounded by other talk show hosts and zillions of people. And Danny Schechter, the media dissector, is in the house. Is in the house, yeah. This microphone seems to want to wander around. Maybe we can tighten it down here a little bit. This is live radio at its livest.
I know. I was in radio for 10 years in Boston, so I know a little about it.
You know the business.
I'm really happy to be on with you, Tom. I'm a great fan of your work and your writing and your commitment to raising issues that are not being raised in our media system. I myself am a refugee from ABC and CNN, a network defector, if you will, and now a news dissector.
There you go.
And running MediaChannel.org, which is the world's largest online media issues network on the Internet, struggling as we are right now for our survival, but trying to raise issues not just about what Fox News is doing wrong, but how our whole media system is failing us. Not just one network, but it cuts across the spectrum of corporate-dominated media, which doesn't allow other voices and more diverse perspectives often to be heard and to be seen. And I know that because I worked on the inside in corporate radio in Boston for many years. I worked at ABC News for 8 years. I was part of the startup team at CNN. I've been at CNBC. And I've seen on the inside how ideas tend to be homogenized, how people tend to do what everybody else is doing and don't raise more important issues. And at least at this conference, important issues that we haven't been talking about or should have been talking about are being put on the agenda, from health care to torture, to the priorities of this administration, which are so at odds with our democracy. So that's why I'm here covering it, but also hoping to contribute to it. My latest project is a film called In Debt We Trust, America Before the Bubble Burst. And this is one of the issues that affects almost everyone in our country, debt. their credit card debts, their mortgage debts, their college loan debts, their student loan debts. All of it is, you know, strangling us. You know, credit cards went from being a luxury to a necessity to a noose around the necks of so many people. Families are struggling to pay their bills. 2 million Americans, 2 million Americans are facing foreclosure from their homes. This is bigger than Katrina. Okay, this is as a result of the subprime lending crisis.
Let me just toss this into perspective and context. 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, how many Americans were facing foreclosure?
I don't think
any historic.
I don't think it was anything on the scale of what we're seeing now, and the ripple effect of this, the housing crisis, if you will, the housing bubble bursting, is impacting the rest of our economy. The people on Wall Street who follow this are really worried about it, because in today's world, bubbles are global, and what starts breaking in one place can hit a tripwire and affect us all. And that's why we're trying to do something about it with this movie, In Debt We Trust, and also a website, StopTheSqueeze.org. The idea is we need debt relief in America the way Bono is crusading in Africa for debt relief.
Right.
We need to stop these foreclosures. We need to try to help our students who are leaving college with $20,000 to $30,000 in debt. And In Debt We Trust is a movie that's trying to raise these issues. We've been showing it around the country, and I think you're going to hear a lot more about it. It's indebtwetrust.com is where you can get the DVD. You know, the model is grassroots distribution and a political campaign alongside the movie, Americans for Debt Relief Now. So that's what we're doing. Now, I'm disappointed that this issue is not really on the agenda here, because there's no organized constituency raising it.
It's sort of all of us.
Yeah. Obviously, when you talk...
Find somebody who's not in debt. I mean,
well, when you talk to everybody, they all... When you say to them, what are you worried about? What keeps you awake at night? They talk about the bills they have to pay, the phone calls they're getting incessantly to pay their bills. But the progressive movement has yet to adopt this issue and make it the kind of major issue it could be to unite people. And that's what I'm hoping to encourage at this Take Back America conference, because even among the leading speakers, we just had the opening plenary, Bob Borisoch and everyone else did a beautiful job of reciting the political failures of this administration and the problems. But what they haven't really focused on is the corporate power, which is blocking change. You know, the credit card company.
You know, the banking industry right now is one of the most powerful and well-funded industries in the United States. It is, you know, they almost never lose. And mortgages in particular are incredibly profitable. I mean, the first few years, with the average person selling their home every 7 years, and the first 5 years of a mortgage, of a typical 20- or 30-year mortgage, being almost 100% profit for the bank, you've got, I mean, these enormous returns on investment. It's an industry that's really, really hard to fail at.
We don't have the accountability. The governor of Massachusetts has now called for criminal penalties against predatory lending institutions.
Sure.
This is the first time that somebody in a position of power and influence is saying we should criminalize these practices and stop people losing their homes and being thrown into the street, basically college students thrown into a kind of serfdom, you know, where there was a report on Common Dreams. Liberal youth can't get into organizing political activism because they have to pay their debts and they have to take the first job they can take. So this is the issue I'm sort of crusading on, but I'm also linking it to the media issue, because we need more attention paid to this problem in our media. You know, the credit card company spent $5 billion in marketing. Their advertising is everywhere. It's pervasive. Just turn on any TV station. There's something about debt, consolidate your debt, or take out a new mortgage, or take out a new loan. It surrounds
promoting debt.
It surrounds us, absolutely.
You know, in the 1920s, it was pretty much unheard of to buy a house on debt. People saved up to buy houses. Most people rented, the majority of people in the United States, or anything else. And RCA started this thing where you could buy a radio on time. and it was the first major consumer debt offering. It was the very first time revolving credit was. Yeah, it was in
so
the 1920s.
Back to the media industry
and
in a way.
It really does. And what's interesting is number one, it turned RCA into a huge business, and it made them very profitable. And number two, some people think that it eventually had something to do with the crash of 29. You know,
I'm just reading about, you know, I was in FM radio news for many years, and you know, of course, they give an award in the name of Major Armstrong, who was the technical genius that created FM radio, and
right.
They don't remind us that he committed suicide because David Sarnoff at RCA at the time, you know, became controlling NBC, basically tried to squash this technology, which is now so common in America. So this
That's
has been a battleground for so many years. We have so much to learn from each other about all of this and why, you know, not only taking back America, but part of it has to be taking back the media. And that's what you're doing, Tom, in a way. You're trying
well,
to...
Well, and you too, Danny. We're talking with Danny Schachter, the media dissector, or the news dissector, and the mediachannel.org, the website. And, Danny, a few minutes ago we were talking about, you know, early in our conversation, about how you've been on the inside with all these big institutions. You were there as part of the startup of CNN, et cetera. And you said you've seen how they end up becoming homogenized. You've seen how they become, you know, kind of American cheesed. How?
Well, first of all, there's been this merger of newsbiz and showbiz techniques. You know, the idea that you have to pander to the audience in order to build ratings. The idea that you have to do what everyone else is doing. You know, if that channel is doing Paris Hilton, you have to do it too because, quote, that's what people want. When you ask people what do they want this, they say no, basically, that they don't want it, but they'll watch it if it's the only thing on TV to watch. The other day, the media industry was denounced for all of its celebrity coverage by none other than, get this, O.J. Simpson, okay? Talk about, you know, the kettle.
Yeah.
You know,
well, O.J. actually, you know, probably knows this better than anybody else. I mean, he was denouncing what happened to him in a way as well.
Well, did you know that he was on the board of directors of Infinity Broadcasting? O.J. Simpson was with Mel Karmazin, who basically went on to Viacom, to CBS Radio. It's now running Sirius Radio.
Of course, it's not uncommon for big corporations to try to have basically a couple of token celebrities, you know, a couple of very famous people on their boards to give them entree to be a front man.
Absolutely, but it's just ironic that this became the obsession. Covering O.J. became the obsession of the media, and he was actually in the media. His whole celebrity was created not only as a sports star but as a commentator and as a personality. So, you know, there's this dialectical connection between celebrity and showbiz and news.
So how do we take back the media, then?
Well,
Danny Schachter?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, the funders of conferences like this, the progressive funders, have to start thinking about not just challenging Fox News, but replacing Fox News with something else, supporting independent media, supporting and building a capacity for independent media. MediaChannel.org may be going out of business this month because of our funding crisis and the inability of us to attract the funders that help get us going. You know, they've moved on. They're much more attracted by partisan politics and being, you know, kind of in with all the big celebs and big candidates, and they're not funding and supporting and marketing and promoting independent media to enhance our voices, if you will, to try to build audience, to help us market, and to, you know, use the techniques that Hollywood uses.
Yeah, we have to wrap it up. Danny Schachter,
the
news dissector, mediachannel.org, the website. Danny, thanks for being
with us.
Thanks
so much, Tom.
45 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
Nine and a half minutes. Tom Hartman here. Before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. Julie Bergman Sender is with me. an experienced filmmaker, a movie executive. First of all, tell me about your movie stuff.
Well, I spent most of my career, first of all, it's a great honor to meet you, and I'm a huge fan of the show, and I listen to it every morning as I'm taking my daughter to school.
Oh, well, thank you.
In between the BlackBerry and the cell phone ringing.
Yeah.
I spent most of my career as a producer and a filmmaker, and at a certain point, when I was pregnant, actually, I said, you know, there must be a way to take all this experience telling stories and merge it with policy and progressive ideas. And she's nine. So I didn't really tell anybody about it for a long time, and I sort of spent a lot of time at this conference and other places and had always been an activist but had never really turned my sort of professional talent towards telling stories, which is what I now do pretty much full time.
You were part of the leadership team that ran National Voices.
Well, National Voice was a coalition in the 2004 election that was actually put together by now Secretary of State Mark Ritchie of Minnesota. And the idea was to create a coalition of up to 1,000, and I think it ended up being actually 1,500 grassroots organizations, some well-known on the national level and some just emerging in communities in the grassroots level, to not only encourage people to be civically engaged, but to get people who were previously underserved to register to vote. And Wieden Kennedy, who is the well-known advertising agency that creates the Nike ads and the Starbucks ads, and I created a media campaign that we made a decision to release completely virally without buying any airtime, because if we were really about powering the people, then we needed to put our money into the ground operation of registering those voters. And we registered 5 million new voters in that campaign.
That's great. That's great. And Karl Rove didn't challenge it?
Not that we know of, although there was a lot of funny business in that election, and I'm sure many of those new registered voters encountered, you know, the problems that...
Well, I say that not facetiously. I mean, this is one of the major things that the U.S. attorneys who did not get fired were doing, was challenging company Acorn, for example.
Yes, they were part of that coalition. And
right.
I mean, what you're raising is the big black cloud that's going to be over this election as well. And I think, you know, my husband and I, who produce all this media together, and we did a big campaign in the 06 election for Women's Voices, Women Vote. And rather than staying home and celebrating in 06, we flew to Washington and we sat in the offices of the lawyers who were going to be monitoring the elections to help monitor certain parts of Florida, certain parts of Ohio, and other places where we joined forces with Guerrilla News Network and dispatched cameras all over the country to record inconsistencies that could perhaps later be useful to the Lawyers Committee as they sought justice.
Why did none of that make mainstream media?
You're asking me that question, really?
Yeah, actually, I am. I've seen so many of these things. You know, Robert Greenwald did a documentary on these. There have been others. And yet, mainstream media will not touch the topic. In fact, I find a lot of mainstream politicians won't even touch the topic. And it's not just radioactive, I think, at the level of corporate. It's radioactive at the level of Democratic Party. And the story that I hear from them is that they're afraid that if people are afraid that the elections are rigged or stolen, that they won't vote. And so we're going to pretend that it's not happening. And thus, the Republicans are getting away with it.
Well, this, I think, you know, is an issue that goes to the center of the larger problem, which is that there is no point in being afraid right now. If ever we were in a transformational moment in our politics, it's now. And fear isn't going to get us out of it, even though fear is what probably can be consigned to have gotten us into it. And I think that, you know, the arguments that were going on inside the election protection community with exactly that argument that you just stated. Some people are afraid that if you talk about it too much, people will say, well, my vote doesn't matter anyway, so I'm not going to go and vote. But again, you know, it's our job now as a progressive movement to brand the big ideas that we stand for. And I believe that this is why the Republicans have been so successful. And I know that that's a dirty word, but I come from Hollywood. So ultimately, my job is to sort of say, look, some of what we do in Hollywood is actually good.
Mm-hmm.
We know how to tell stories. We know how to get people emotionally engaged. And emotional engagement and intellectual engagement have to walk hand in hand, and one is not better than the other. But often, you know, progressives and Democrats feel uncomfortable when they start talking about marketing and branding. But the truth is if we don't start marketing what we are authentically about, we're not going to win yet again, even though we're completely poised to take it back.
Yeah, it really strikes me that the last Democrat who called out the Republicans on what they were about, economic royalism, was Franklin Roosevelt. It's like the Democrats have lost not only their own brand, but the counter brand. We just have a minute. The projects that you're working on now, what are you most passionate about? What would you like to tell our listeners about?
Well, I'm really most passionate about continuing to work with organizations, of which we have several that we're working with, where we take the great work that they're doing that may not be as easy to digest if you're in Washington and you're thinking on a policy point of view. We're doing a project around national security. We're doing another voter engagement project directed to the 22 million women who didn't vote in the 2000 election. And now the work that we've done with Women's Voices, Women's Vote has gotten it down to you know, now there's 2 million more single women who are voting, and we're going to keep at that because that is the holy grail of voters for both parties right now, and they understand this intersection between cultural messaging and political ideas.
Yeah, indeed, and the important stuff. Julie Sender, Bergman Sender. Thanks so much for being with us and
Thank you, Tom. Great
work that you're doing.
Thank you so much.
We need, you know, it's. Boy, we so need to get the word out. Just so much work to do, and we're doing it here at this conference, the Take Back America Conference. We'll be right back.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. To the Tom Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back to the second hour of the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference here in Washington, D.C., put on by the Center for America's, it's ourfuture.org. Is
Jan, Campaign for America.
Campaign for America's Future. Thank you. Oh, man. There's so many great organizations out there. Jan Schakowsky is with us, Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky of the 9th District in Illinois. And, by the way, lest I forget, I want to mention to our listeners who are bloggers and blogging and folks on the Internet that the blog over at airamerica.com, the Tom Hartman blog, today, as we did all last week, we're going to give away a copy of my new book, just out in paperback, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, to the person who posts what, in my producer David Poole's totally arbitrary opinion, is the best blog for the day, the best, you know, comment for the day. So you can get over to airamerica.com and toss in your thoughts on the day, any aspect of it as well. Also, some just absolutely bizarre things going on in the news, which we will be getting to as the program goes on. But Congresswoman Schakowsky, you're on the House Intelligence Committee.
I am.
And one of the founding notions of this country, in fact, one of the founding notions of government, going back, you know, arguably to Sumeria 7,000 years ago, was that there are some things that we collectively do because they collectively affect all of us. And so they should not be put in the hands of a small number of people who have a particular agenda, like, for example, making a profit. This is why we collectively pay for our police departments, our fire departments, our traffic signs, and, you know, these things that collectively, we call this the commons. Our military, from the founding of this country, has been considered one of the more vital parts of our commons. And yet, I understand that there are nearly as many private contractors in Iraq as there are American soldiers, and that many of them are armed and that they're operating under rules of engagement that are nothing close to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and they're earning far more than our individual soldiers. This is an issue that frankly concerns me greatly, and I'm wondering if you can speak to it and how, if you think, and if so, how you think Congress may be speaking to this.
Well, I've really drilled down.
I need you to be real.
I've really tried to drill down on this issue of the use of private military contractors. The
privatization of our military, the outsourcing of the use of force. It is a relatively new notion in the...
Well, we used to call them mercenaries.
Exactly. I think the label is actually quite apt in many situations. In this case, I'm not really talking so much about the Halliburtons, although we have to worry about waste, fraud, and abuse. There are big winners in this war, companies that are making mega, mega bucks, billions of dollars. But I've been looking at this issue of the use of force. And in a way, the way we've defined states, nations in recent history is to have a hegemony over force. You're right. I mean those were considered inherently governmental functions.
Right.
And yet very few people really know. It's starting to come out now that there are these armed mercenaries in Iraq working for companies that have really developed in many ways since 9/11 to fill in the gap. And the fact that we as Americans know very little about it means we don't know about nearly half the war, because we have as many of these troops, as many of these private contractors as we have troops almost in
Iraq.
It was
the four Blackwater contractors getting torched, murdered in a horrific way, and two of them hung from the bridge back in Fallujah that arguably led to the ultimate near destruction
exactly.
of that city
they
by our military.
They are shaping the mission. So it's not as if they're just in support positions. They are also interpreters. They are interrogators at Abu Ghraib in some instances.
And there's some allegations that they were the ones that were driving the process that ultimately was felonious there.
At least some of them were private contractors. And so you're right. What are the rules of engagement? Are they reporting to the CEO or are they reporting to the combatant commander? Now, we have in the Congress tried to clear that up and make it clear that the military person is in charge, even of the contractors. But, you know, you've got some of these guys, and I'm not saying that they're not patriots, but they're former special forces or Navy SEALs. They have a lot of experience, and we know of some incidents where they're actually giving commands to our own rather inexperienced and often undertrained troops. We also know of incidents where these guys have been walking around with guns, shooting at cars. There was a murder that was perpetrated by a Blackwater employee on Christmas Eve within the green zone, and yet there are only two instances of contractors actually being prosecuted in any way. We don't
Why
know
is that?
Because they're in this gray legal limbo, and we don't really know how to prosecute them, and partly because Bremer, when he headed up the CPA, what was that, the Provisional Authority in Iraq, gave them immunity.
Right.
Said they were immune from any prosecution. Imagine that. So who really is calling the shots there? What are they doing? How many have died? We don't count them among the dead.
Right.
The only way we know that about 1,000 of them have been killed is that they've applied for insurance, which once again, American taxpayers are paying for. So this is billions of dollars going to private contractors, taxpayer dollars. And we know precious little about how they're operating.
Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky is with us. And we're just now learning that the surge, in quotes, has really just maintained the force levels in Iraq over the last year, because so many soldiers from countries other than the United States have been leaving Iraq. That you know, it's really not a surge in the broadest sense, other than Americans. I mean, more Americans, fewer Spaniards. You know, for example, they pulled out some time ago.
Right.
And how do we?
By the way, though, these private groups are hiring people from the countries even that have pulled out. There's a number of Chileans, there's Hondurans that are there in Iraq. So even countries who have said that they will not participate, a number of their nationals are hired on as contractors, sometimes actually even abused. We've heard of Hondurans whose passports were taken away. They were paid far less than they had been promised that they would pay, and they're kind of stuck there in Iraq.
Wow. That's sort of like the labor folks, you know, who are being hired by some of our corporations there, who are now coming out and saying that, you know, they came from Bangladesh or Sri Lanka,
right,
and their passports were taken away and they're working for nothing, and they thought they were going to a job in Jordan and they ended up in Iraq and that kind of thing.
Exactly.
I mean, we have a really terrible mess here in Iraq, and it seems that so much of it has philosophy at its foundation. This idea that if we just allow this fundamentally conservative idea that if we just allow the, quote, free market, if we just allow the corporations to take charge, then everything will be fine. Let's just get government out of the way.
Yeah, but if you've got that in the conduct of war, and you've got a company, let's say Blackwater, that has its own fixed-wing aircraft and its own helicopters and its own small and large arms, plus they say they have 20,000 people at the ready to go, well, then, does the president, any president, need to really come to Congress and say, well, we want to go here, or we want to invade Iran, or we have another little mission that we want to do somewhere in Africa?
Well, this is, you know, Cy Hirsch says we've already got people inside Iran, and they're contractors.
So, and that was true.
You know,
before
doing sabotage.
And that was true before the invasion of Iraq, where bases were being built, and you know, things were absolutely happening. And the fact that there has not been any. For example, the American people, the Congress might say, okay, well, we have private people handing out meals, or you know, doing. We don't need KP duty anymore, peeling up potatoes. But when you've got these armed forces roaming around Iraq, unaccountable as far as we really know to anybody, this is a serious problem.
Well, and the meals in the mail as well. I mean, what we're finding is that the water is polluted, that some of the meals are substandard, that all in the name of profits. I actually had a woman on the program whose son was killed because the company Halliburton that was delivering the mail decided that it was too dangerous to deliver the mail that week, and so the only way that the soldiers could get their mail was to drive out to the airport at Baghdad, and he got blown up on the road.
Well, that's a great point, because if the going gets tough, these private contractors can say bye-bye. We're not doing it.
Yeah.
And so then we're left with our kids doing these missions that they've defined.
Right, and they just say it's not profitable. Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, thanks for the great work you're doing.
It's such an honor to be on your show. Oh, thank you. You're doing a great job.
Thank you. Thank you for being with us. And janschakowsky.org, right?
That's right.
Great website.
Great.
Thank you. It's 16 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Radio Program right here on Air America Radio.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
I think we've all had enough. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Investigation uncovers extensive destruction of RNC emails, violations of Records Act. House investigators have learned this from the Center for American Progress's blog over at thinkprogress.org. House investigators have learned that the Bush administration's use of Republican National Committee email accounts is far greater than previously disclosed. 140,216 emails sent or received by Karl Rove alone. And that the RNC, I've been telling you this for a long time, this has become a criminal organization. They are operating like the mafia. The RNC has overseen extensive destruction of many of the emails, including all email records for 51 White House officials. We'll get back to that in a little bit. And right now, Andrea Schlesinger is with us. She's the executive director of the Drum Major Institute, originally founded by an advisor to the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. The Institute dedicated to finding ways to make the government and elected officials accountable and to improve the lot of all Americans. DrumMajorInstitute.org, the website. Andrea, welcome.
Thank you.
Great to have you here with us.
Thanks.
What do you mean by improving the lot of all Americans?
Well, I think we have something in common, which is a concern for the plight of America's middle class and a belief that looking at the health of the middle class is the number one indicator of the strength of the economy and the strength of your public policy. And, you know, the work that we do is really to find ways to engage the middle class in understanding the public policies that impact them and in getting other people to pay attention to their faith.
And how do you do that?
we produce tools, whether it's research. You know, we produced a framework looking at the interests of the middle class in immigration policy. We produce annual scorecards of members of Congress based on how they voted on legislation of importance to the current and aspiring middle class. You know, we collect model policies from around the country, since one of the best ways to prove that a progressive government can work is to show when it does and show how it has. You know, so that's some of the work that we do.
Don't you? You know, we're seeing the absolute disasters and failures of conservative policies. Hurricane Katrina is a classic example. You know, the response of the Bush administration was to basically do nothing except put up a website for FEMA that pointed people to Operation Blessing and the Red Cross. And then Operation Blessing took in millions of dollars, and Pat Roberts and company, and frankly, I have no idea where it went. I'm not sure anybody else does. And yet these are not being overtly and explicitly labeled as failures of conservative philosophy or conservative governance. Why?
Well, I think that they are, but I think that's part of the gathering here, is the intent is to call it what it is, which is a failure of an ideology. I think some of it is, that we haven't made that case yet enough to the mainstream American public. I think some of it is that we're afraid to call things ideology, because then we'll have to defend our own. And so, you know, I think that there are... I think some of it is that the message just hasn't rippled yet, or that people sense things, but we haven't yet given it a name.
Right.
And I think some of it is our own fear that if we start doing ideology versus ideology, we're not sure exactly where we'll stack up.
But, it seems to me like ideology versus ideology is a great place to start.
Well, that's definitely where we start, and I think we need to define and do more to define the difference between progressives and conservatives, the difference between the left and the right. To me, the difference is the role that government plays in our lives and the role that we're willing to allow corporate power to play in our lives.
I agree. I've heard some very squishy definitions of progressive and for that matter, of conservative, and really it boils down to just this very, very simple notion that progressives believe that the purpose of government is to empower us all to become everything that we can, and conservatives believe that the power of government is to punish evil people and to protect us from other evil people, period, end of discussion. And this country was founded by progressives. It was founded on a very progressive notion. You know, the six items listed in the preamble of the Constitution, provide for the common defense, arguably is the conservative end of it, but there were five other things in there,
And I think that we often forget our history and what it meant when the word progressive took shape and when it took form and when the movement took form. But I think that this conference and other efforts are a perfect opportunity to not just say, hey, let's win an election, but let's try to make a case about an ideology that best represents us.
Yeah, and the Drum Major Institute doing that, drummajorinstitute.org, the website. Andrea Schlesinger, our guest, the executive director. Where did the name come from?
We don't do drum lessons, so that's the first piece, but we were founded during the Civil Rights Movement, and Dr. King would often talk about a drum major instinct, that instinct to lead larger movements, and how it could be used for good, how it could be used for bad, but it was actually the theme of his last sermon before he was killed, his last sermon at Ebenezer.
Is the drum major the beat keeper for a band?
Yes.
It is like the heartbeat of the...
Exactly.
That's the title of the person who has the big drum that is keeping the beat?
Not the drum, but there's a name for that thing that I'm blanking on now.
Oh, essentially a conductor.
Right. How that instinct to set those beats could be used for good and bad, and he explored those themes, and that's what we try to do. There are people who should be out in the front lines, and then there are people like us who hopefully are providing them with the intellectual information and the actual, concrete tools that they can use in their advocacy.
Right. Great. Well, it's great to have you with us, and I'm so pleased that you're out there doing the work. Andrea Schlesinger, she's the executive director of the Drum Major Institute, drummajorinstitute.org, the website if you want to check it out. 27 minutes past the hour, we'll be giving away a copy of Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It to our best blog today over at airamerica.com. Check it out.
Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Songs from back home. Home on the range. Oh, give me a home where no liberals roam and the folks all think the same way. Where each house has a gun, a big caliber one, and strangers are told, make my day. three-syllable word or so, then it's one I can say.
All right, let's segue away from the George Bush pastiche and into something rational. Congressman Keith Ellison is here with us.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Keith, or Congressman, it's great to have you with us. It is great to have you with us. 35 minutes past the hour, and we're back broadcasting live from the Take Back America conference here in Washington, D.C. Economic justice. In the last legislative session, not the current one, but the one prior to
ninth Congress.
Yeah. We saw the passage of the so-called bankruptcy reform, so-called credit reform, a series of very, very toxic bills that make it harder and harder and harder for average people, working people in America, to get by and make them much more vulnerable to the predations of large corporations, banks, credit card companies, and the like, and have largely immunized the latter. What are you all doing about it?
Well, let me tell you, one thing that I'm working on, and a number of Congress people are too, is we're trying to have some credit justice. First of all, we're working hard on this credit card thing. You and I came on the air a few weeks ago and talked about this bill I've introduced to stop universal default.
Right.
That's when your credit score goes up, on then they can jack up your interest rates automatically.
Right across the board.
Right across the board. But then also, we got bills coming through the line to stop double cycle billing. That's when if you put $5,000 on the credit card and you pay $4,000, they're going to charge you interest on the $5,000.
Right.
You know, and then stopping pay to pay. That means how many times have you called up and said, I want to pay my bill, and then they charge you to pay the bill.
Right.
So that's crazy. But so all these little ways that they dig into your income.
Isn't it like every time, you know, it's like whack-a-mole? I mean,
yeah.
You know, every time you regulate them in one area, they'll just come up with some new scheme. They'll say, oh, you wrote us a check? There's
right.
a fee for that now.
Right.
It's free if it's electronic. And then when most people are doing it electronic, oh, you want to do it electronically? There's a fee for that now.
Right.
I mean, it's bizarre.
But see, we are smart enough and quick enough and able enough in the progressive movement to deal with this.
Yeah.
So we don't get discouraged by their quickie little machinations, right? We just keep on, as they come up, we whack that mole, you know? and see, you know, the thing about it is, man, is it's very expensive to be poor, and it's very expensive to be working class.
It is.
Because, you know, and so what we've got to do is push this pendulum back the other way.
Yeah.
And I think that if we start talking about how they're just abusing folks, I mean, let me tell you, half the big credit card companies don't do universal default. So what's the justification that the other half have for doing it? Well, they just want to get money.
Yeah.
Get money.
Yeah.
However way they can. And we have to say no to it because our silence really helps them out.
Yeah.
You know. And so the thing is, we need to raise the voices. You know, Tom, one of the problems with this whole credit justice issue is that a lot of us have internalized the value system of the people who are taking our money.
Yeah.
So we feel ashamed. And we suffer in silence.
You know, that really started with Reagan.
Yeah.
Prior to Reagan, prior to the early 1980s, if a CEO was taking obscene salaries, it was embarrassing.
Right.
If a company was laying people off, it was viewed as a bad sign, as a tragedy, as a negative thing. It, you know, their stock would go
You're
down.
Right.
Now it's the exact opposite.
Opposite.
And that's not the historic American way. I mean, there have been a couple of aberrations. There
sure.
was the Roaring Twenties that led to the Republican Great Depression. There was the time of the robber barons that led to the progressive era. You know,
yeah.
Teddy Roosevelt. And we're seeing now these echoes of Reaganism, these 26-year
yeah.
period of Reaganism, producing this, frankly, I'd say, a progressive and populist backlash.
Well, let's not make it a backlash. Let's make it just a lash. Right?
A forward lash. There you go.
Right,
yeah,
right, right.
Yeah, let's move forward and
yeah.
do something good and positive and productive with it.
Shared prosperity.
Yeah.
We all do better when we all do better. That's
yeah.
what Paul Wellstone used to say, that we're all in this thing together, and we got to make sure that we all have enough to take care of our families, have a secure retirement, can fund a decent education system so our kids have a chance. And another thing, Tom, is along with this, is this trade stuff.
Mm.
This trade stuff's coming up this summer. You know, it's coming up now, really. You know, this fast track authority or
sure.
trade promotion authority is coming up this summer. I'm dead set against giving this president any kind of authority over trade. You know, I think that the fact is we cannot continue to support the exportation of American workers,
yeah.
Jobs. And as a matter of fact, you know, We can't continue to lay back passively when union workers in Columbia are catching it in the back of the head because they're trying to organize people on their jobs.
Yeah.
I mean, you can get a $50 washing machine, but it comes at the price of an American job, and it comes at the price of a Colombian life. And we cannot abide that, man. We just got to say no to it, and we got to be organized, we got to be clear, and we got to make our stand.
Yeah, we're in a very real way supporting something close to slave labor all around the world.
No doubt.
And because it's not happening in the United States, you know, we say, oh, we did away with slavery. Isn't that a great thing?
Right.
Sorry.
Yeah, well, we can't promote it in another name somewhere else.
Right, this computer right here was made in China.
Right.
I just don't have to look into the face of those of the slaves that made that. And that's the thing. Americans, we just don't, you know, if it doesn't exist, if we don't see it and touch it, or if we don't, you know, it seems not to exist. And
well, that's why we got to fight to keep the airwaves open.
Yeah.
See, if we can keep the airwaves open, and we can keep the internet free and the radio waves open, we can know what's going on. But if they shut that down, then we're in real trouble, so we've got to make sure.
So how's net neutrality doing?
Well, let me tell you, man, there's a lot of people in Congress who know that we've got to keep the Internet wide open and free, and there's a strong backlash against trying to narrow the field. So I think it's doing better.
Yeah.
But I think we got to keep up the fight, and you got to keep banging the gong from these radio waves. And I'm going to tell you, man, if we lost every civil right except for the right to free speech, we could get them all back. But once we lose that one, we're in real serious trouble.
Yeah. On the other hand, you look at a number of countries where there was no right to free speech,
right,
where the government owned all the media, and yet there have been citizens' movements that have risen up.
No, you're right.
I have a lot of hope. I didn't mean that to contradict you. My point was that I believe that almost no matter how bad it gets, it's in our DNA in this country. I mean, we haven't always walked the talk, but we've talked the talk. It's burned into us, this idea of an egalitarian,
right,
relatively progressive, certainly small d democratic society.
Yeah.
And not only can we not let it go away, I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think we're going to.
Now, they can't stamp out the flame. But, you know, there's some big things coming up, and we got some real opportunities to move the movement forward.
Yeah.
And I'm just hoping that this summer that people will get real focused on trade issues. And we really start thinking. See, right now there's this thing on the table for the Peru and Panama trade agreements.
Right.
They've said that, okay, we're going to have labor standards in there and environmental standards in there. But the fact is the level of enforceability for those standards is weak. And also the next thing coming up is South Korea and Colombia.
Yeah.
Now, you know, South Korea, we sell about 4,000 or so cars in South Korea. They sell 800,000 here.
Right.
We got a trade imbalance with a capital B. We got to stop that, and we can't. Trade agreements have to be looked at from the vantage point of do they promote American jobs or not. At this point, they're looked at as do they help multinationals make more money or not.
Yeah, and that's the bottom line. I mean, there was an interesting piece in the Financial Times Thursday or Friday last week, and it's interesting to read the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
Read the power structure talking to itself, you know.
Yeah.
And it was about India. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about how 40% of the entire economy of India is the retail sector, which is probably about the same in the United States. I don't know the stats for the United States, but 40% of all the entire GDP of India is the retail sector. And it is against the law to have a chain store in India. It's just plain old flat out against the law.
Sure.
Walmart has gone in and tried. They say, sorry, you cannot. There's not one Walmart store in India. There's nothing even like Walmart. 97% of the Indian retailers are not corporations. They are individuals. They're family businesses. 97%. Only 3% even bothered to incorporate. And you look at that, and at the same time, you've got these guys like Tom Friedman running around going, the world is flat, the world is flat, look at this. Look at India, isn't it a wonderful example? And you look at India, and you say, okay, you know, what are they doing right? Well, you know, they're protecting their retail trade. They're protecting small entrepreneurs. So, you know, China, if we make a car and we try to export it into China, they charge a 20% tariff at the border.
Yep.
If they make a car and send it to us, we charge a 2% tariff. What's wrong with this picture?
Well, you know, what's wrong with the picture is that the American people have got to rise up and take our economic future in our own hands. And we've got to understand that, you know, not every multinational company is looking out for us.
Yeah. Well, I'd say none of them. I mean, these transnational corporations are looking out for themselves only.
Well, yeah, I would be facetious, but, you know, the point is that, you know, economic justice has got to be the thing, Tom. And I love the fact that you're writing about it, you're talking about it, you're doing all these important things. And let me tell you why. Not only is it going to have put more food on the table, but it's a galvanizing issue. Yeah. It's an issue that unites us across color lines, religious lines, regional lines. Yeah. Whether you're in Minnesota or whether you are in Paris, Texas, you understand when a credit card company is being unfair to you. Whether you are, no matter what religion you are, you understand that if you're losing your job so that somebody else can be abused in some other country, that it hurts you and it hurts them too.
Right.
So it's a galvanizing issue. This issue of economic populism is critical, and I hope you keep banging the gong, Tom.
Well, and I hope you do too in Congress, Congressman Ellison.
Well, together
Ellison.
We will, brother.
Yeah. Keith Ellison, Congressman Keith Ellison, member of Congress from Minnesota, thanks so much for being with
us. You got it. Keep
always
it
great talking with
every
you.
Every time.
45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference, ourfuture.org, the website, here in the belly of the beast, Washington, D.C. Tom Hartman with you on Air America Radio. Bob Borisage is with us. He is the co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, and a fine campaign it is, Bob.
It's great. It's a great conference here.
It's great to have you with us. First of all, snapshot of the conference. How's it doing?
3,000 progressives, 40 states, across the various tribes of the progressive movement, leaders, activists. It's enormous energy. And people are really, I think, beginning to understand the increasing power and capacity of this progressive movement and how it's driving our national political debate.
Do you think that the Democratic Party is having one of those sort of aha moments the way the Republican Party did in arguably the late 70s, but certainly in 81 when Reagan was installed, that there is an ideological movement, and I mean that in a positive sense, not a negative one, that has the potential to drive the party again, that did, you know, once in the past, just like the conservative movement drove the Republican Party during Reconstruction? And
I think we're getting there. More and more of them are getting it. They started to get it in 06 when progressives really helped expand the election and win seats that they never thought were in play.
Yeah.
And the progressive blogosphere, MoveOn.org, and a whole range of other groups really helped elect the new majority that now exists in the House and Senate. I think they see it on issues where you've seen the presidential candidates, the Democratic candidates, moving more and more to a tougher, more progressive position on the war, on health care, on energy, on the economy.
And yet at the same time, after the elections of 06, you had Chris Matthews come out and say, well, it was the conservative Democrats who won. You had the Washington Post saying it was the conservative Democrats who won. You had the New York Times saying it was the Democratic Party moves to the right. I mean, this was the meme. I think, frankly, most Americans to this day believe that that was the reality, that the Democratic Party moved to the right in the 06 election. How does this nonsense stand, A, and how do we rebut it?
Well, it's not real. There is this conventional wisdom that America is by default a conservative country. And so we just put out a report this week with Media Matters.
It's brilliant.
Taking the most neutral polling and showing that on issue after issue, the vast majority of Americans are with a progressive position or moving our way in increasing numbers. And we're trying to challenge this kind of default assumption of the media and then add to that some information for them about this kind of increased capacity on the left of this party. You know, labor now has a aggressive education program that reaches 25% of the electorate come from labor households. MoveOn.org has 3.3 million members. It's raising over $25 million in the last cycle, which is an off-year cycle. It will raise an extraordinary amount of money and volunteers and hours over the next period of time. On and on, there is increasing capacity, increasing resources, increasing energy on the progressive side of the spectrum. The politicians have started to learn that because they have to respond to it. They feel the heat.
Right.
The press is slower to get to it. But I think in this conference, there's suddenly the beginnings of people seeing it.
Right. I'm curious about fratricide, splits with schisms within the progressive movement. We're certainly seeing them in the conservative movement. They tend to happen when movements are dying, but they also tend to happen when movements are first acquiring power and wealth and growing.
Yep.
What do you see and what do we do about it?
Well, you can see it with the disappointment, widespread disappointment among progressives and liberals and activists in the country when the Congress passed the second supplemental after Bush vetoed the first supplemental with the war with the
dates. I had dinner with a member of Congress a couple nights ago, and he asked me, why do you think that the Congress has fallen so much in the polls just in the last couple of weeks? And I said it was that vote.
Yeah, no question.
You know?
And the Post had a poll that showed it was liberal support that collapsed for the Congress. And
yeah.
It was liberals saying, wait a minute, we didn't give you this mandate, we gave you a different mandate.
Yeah, I think it was American support. I mean, you know, it's even Republicans are...
Yeah. So you can see that frustration. You can hear it in this conference. But I think two things are going to happen. One is, the reality is Bush unites progressives.
But Bush isn't running for office.
But every Republican candidate in this race is adopting, for reasons that I cannot imagine, Bush's policies on the war, on the economy, on social issues. These guys have put themselves in a corner with the most unpopular president since Nixon.
Well, except that he is still popular and well over 50% with Republicans who are registered to vote and vote in primaries.
Right.
So all of these guys have to pander to their base.
So they're either going to have to move dramatically after one of them gets the nomination,
or you're
going to have the most polarized election with the Democratic candidate, no matter who it is out of this field, being against the war, being for national health care, being for a concerted drive towards energy independence, being for a different economic course in terms of empowering workers and getting corporations under control. That's going to be a huge stark contrast with that Republican candidate, and so that will help organize us. But I do think, you know, as this movement gets more powerful, it has every reason to have higher expectations and to be dissatisfied when they aren't met.
Right, and to avoid schism. I mean,
Well, you got to avoid schism, but you got to keep putting pressure on your representatives to do the right thing and to stand up. I mean,
absolutely.
A lot of these congresspeople have to learn once again how to fight. There's a long
It's almost like a Stockholm syndrome. You know, you hear these guys going, well, we had to vote for the war supplemental because if we didn't, then George Bush would have put some, mother of some Iraqi kid on TV. It's like, so what?
Right, exactly.
You know,
he's listening to George Bush.
Yeah, I mean, well, so he does. He puts some mother of some Iraqi kid on TV. Then, you know, we need to stand up, or our members of Congress need to stand up and say, yes, we understand that kid's got a problem in Iraq, and we're going to solve the problem not by sending him some more bullets. We're going to solve the problem by bringing him back to the United States.
No, exactly. But you've got to have the willingness to fight and to keep fighting. We're headed into very fierce battles. You know, once healthcare gets engaged and the insurance industry and the drug companies get moving.
It's going to be wild.
Bob Boris has to fight.
Indeed.
Time.
Bob Boris, ourfuture.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour, broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. And Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey is with us. Congresswoman Woolsey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Great for having us. Great to have you here with us. You co-chair of the Progressive Caucus, which was founded by my friend Bernie Sanders.
Absolutely.
And Bernie's been on this show every Friday for the last 3.5 years. He's just a marvelous guy.
And the Out of Iraq Caucus is now bicameral because he is remains a member.
And he's in the Senate.
Of the Progressive Caucus.
Yeah, and it's a marvelous thing. And you have been working against this war even basically since before it was a war. In fact, I would say that it's not a war any longer. It's an occupation.
It is an occupation.
Yeah, and I think that George Bush was right in 2004, in May of 2003, when he said the war is over, and we won, because we did. We knocked over a government. You know, we took their institutions. We did all those things that you do when you win a war, and then began the occupation, and now we've got this 3 years of failed occupation. What do we do?
Well, we put pressure on those in control. I mean, we elected Democrats to be the majority party so that the Democrats would step up and be bold, and even knowing that the president is going to veto anything that comes out, even anything we support. I don't support anything he does, but anything the Democrats
right.
could possibly support that he brings forward, he vetoes that too. So we have to be bold. We have to come with ideas and visions, and we have to support fully funding, bringing our troops home, and our government contractors, and then reinvesting back in Iraq.
Do you think, Congresswoman, that if Newt Gingrich was leading the Republican Party in Congress, and Bill Clinton was president, and the situation was reversed, that Newt Gingrich would have put forward as the second try after Clinton vetoed a funding bill that said you've got to get out within a certain number of months or within a year, that Gingrich would have said, okay, we'll give you what you want?
Absolutely not.
Then why do the Democrats this time?
I don't know, because I certainly was not in support of that plan. I think there's still this fear that if Democrats want to bring our troops home and fully fund bringing our troops home, nobody wants to just drag them out of there and have them be unsafe while we're doing that.
Sure.
We want them equipped. We want them fully prepared. While over like 6 months, get them out of there.
Yeah.
People, too many members are afraid that looks like cut and run, that we don't support the troops, and the American people know better.
They, in other words, too many of the Democratic members of the House and Senate have bought into the talking points of the right?
I believe so. And
how do we wake them up?
The public has to do that. Grassroots. I don't know how much more they can do than having elected us to be, the party in control. They said loud and clear in November, we want you because we think you will do something differently to bring our troops home. That was the main issue. So one of the things members, particularly new members who got elected because they were different than their Republican opponent on this war, they have to do the right thing. You can't fund a war you're against. An occupation. I agree with you. It's an occupation.
Yeah, in fact, we need to stop using the word war because nobody wants to lose a war.
No,
but everybody wants to end an occupation.
Well, you can't win an occupation.
That's right. That's right. Well, actually, the way you win an occupation is by ending it.
That's right.
Right? So it's an appropriate thing. So changing the lexicon and yet the media, I mean, you know, all the networks, they've got war in Iraq, they've, you know, the war.
Mm-hmm. And the word win.
Yeah.
There's no winning there, matter what.
But just the word war in and of itself, it seems to me that should be something that the Democrats in Congress should be challenging loudly and daily. The day that appropriation was passed, that the Iraq supplemental, the day that was passed, I believe it was Mitch McConnell, who was one of the leading Republicans, came forward and said, we're no longer in a war, we're in an occupation. And it was the New York Times, I mean, you know, right there. And the first thought that went through my mind is, these guys are going to do what the Democrats were demanding be done. They're going to start, you know, in the spring, they're going to start pulling down the troops. They're going to have them out of there before the elections so that the Republican Party doesn't get hurt by this war, by this occupation. See, now I'm doing it too. And so it's going to look like the Democrats voted for an ongoing occupation, but the Republicans actually resolved it.
Well, actually, if the Democrats would pull all together for some bold steps, even though the president's going to veto them,
then I believe moderate Republicans would come with us.
Yeah.
And then
on the
pressure,
second or third or fourth vote.
Then the pressure is on the White House to pay attention to their own vote, their own party.
Right. I'm curious to what extent you think that your constituents, excuse me, not your your colleagues in the House and Senate, in the Democratic Party, who are not taking these more progressive positions and yet who may be inclined to by intellect or temperament, are doing so because they genuinely fear the backlash, you know, the Stockholm syndrome, the battered wife syndrome, which it almost seems is going on, or that money is such a big factor in politics and there's so much money to be made on this occupation that you've got all these big companies that are shoveling campaign contributions into people's coffers.
Those who have the progressive bent, it's not about money.
Yeah.
I can assure you.
No,
it's about following their leadership, our leadership.
Sure.
Wanting our leadership to be successful and believing our leadership knows more than they do about a lot of this. But the people of America have spoken, and they're clear that they elected us and that we do have the leadership in the House of Representatives because we were expected to do something about bringing our troops home. And even if it fails, if we stand up for the right things, then we're giving Democrats and progressives something to stand behind.
Yeah, I agree. And your fellow here is telling us that your time is, you've got to move on. So, Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey, thanks so much for being
Thank
with
you,
us.
Thank you, Tom.
And thanks for the great work that you're doing.
Thank you
there.
Very much.
It's marvelous to have you with us. 13 minutes past the hour, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Number 12 in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, number 12, what's up?
Hey.
You are on the air.
Oh, I am. Cool.
Yeah.
Your guest left, right?
Yeah. Well, actually, Bob Greenwald is here with us. And, in fact, let me just put you on hold here, number 12, for just a minute. I'm sorry. Robert Greenwald.
How here, are you?
Grab these headphones. We've got another 2.5 minutes or so before the music bumps us.
Okay.
Robert Greenwald, the world-famous, literally, Brave New Films filmmaker. You've done some great work. What's hot for you right now?
Well, we've been focusing on the short video pieces. We've done 7 or 8 of them, one on Fox attacks and Peach Gonzalez on the war. And if you go to bravenewfilms.org, you can see them. And most important, they're short pieces where we ask people to take action and get involved. What we premiered here today is Lift the Ban, and it's to remove the insanity of the fact that gay translators, when we need translators desperately, mm-hmm. are being fired.
Yeah.
And
lift the ban on gays in the military, in other words.
Yes.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah. Or and no no.
Don't ask.
Yeah.
But it's and if you go to the website, we ask people to sign the petition, to get involved. And the beauty of these short pieces is you can do something. You can pass them around
right.
to friends. And then they get on the front page of YouTube, and suddenly we're reaching hundreds of thousands of people who have gone there to find about a dog in a baby carriage.
Right.
And there's one of these political videos.
So the more often people view them, the more often they vote for them, they rank them, the more they bubble up.
Exactly. They bubble up. And then we're getting not only the core audience, but we're getting a huge additional audience, which is critically important, because what we want to use these shorts for is to reach people who we might not otherwise reach people,
right.
and to activate them.
Right. I think it's so cool that you're doing this, and I don't see any kind of financial model in this. You're doing this for the cause.
Oh, no financial model. These are free.
And there's no advertising. There's no payment,
advertising.
There's
and yeah. it is to reach hearts and affect minds and get people doing stuff, and there's so much stuff people can do today, and a variety of issues. With the Fox attacks, we had great success in convincing the Nevada Democrats not to carry the debate.
Yep.
We've had success with Fox attacks, Black America, in getting candidates to pull out of the Congressional Black Institute debate.
Mm-hmm.
With Impeach Gonzalez, we got 75,000 people in 2 weeks to sign a petition
wow.
saying he should be impeached.
Wow.
So it's an extraordinary opportunity for progressives, because we don't need $500 million to buy CBS.
There you go.
We can reach people.
There you go. And you're doing it. Bob Greenwald, bravenewfilms.org, the website. And just absolutely marvelous work you're doing. Thanks so much, sir, for being with us.
My pleasure.
It's 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio.
You're listening
listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Now back to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
And the modern world is here in Washington, D.C., where we're broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference, ourfuture.org, the website. And by the way, the best blog over at airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page, on the Tom Hartman page over at airamerica.com today, the best blog will receive a, you know, and this is totally arbitrary. It's in the opinion of my producer, David Poole. So whatever he thinks, well, you know, whatever tickles his fancy. Will receive a free copy of Screw, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, my new book. It's new out in paperback. Paige Gardner is here with us. Paige conceived of and founded Women's Voices, Women's Vote. And the website, wvwv.org, which makes sense. Hey, Paige.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you with us. Single women are being left out. How so?
Well, they underparticipate and undervote compared to their married sisters. I mean, the marriage gap is really the defining force in 21st century America. They are the largest progressive bloc we have in this country today. Even though they underparticipate, they are a surging force in the electorate. They are a surging force in terms of our political advocacy. And our job is to make sure that their voices are heard.
Well, first of all, why, if they're so progressive, and they're out there, and you know, there's not a lot of impediments to voting in the United States. It's that arguably there are some you have to register in advance and all that kind of thing in many states. Why are they not participating?
Think of their lives. 66% of these women make $50,000 or less. They have less health care. They have less health insurance than married women. They are less able to own their own homes or have cars. They are stretched economically. What we do is bring voting and the process to them to fit into their lives. That's one. Two, our elected officials are not talking to them about what they care about. And so they don't think that the rhetoric is relevant to their lives. They're just trying to make ends meet. They're trying to get a job to support their family. They're trying to find affordable health care. So once politicians and elected officials begin to speak to them about their lives and their needs, they will participate in greater numbers, as we saw in 2004 and in 2006.
It seems that when speaking of single women, that there are really two groups here. There are single mothers and there are single
non-mothers.
Yeah, I, you know, lack a word. And I'm guessing that there are significant demographic, and probably at a level that couldn't quite be described as cultural, but something like that, perspective differences, issue differences between those two groups.
Actually, 20% of all women on their own are single moms, and actually, there's not that big of a difference. The key thing is that these women are on their own. They're making it on their own. They're proud of being on their own. They're proud of being able to support themselves and their family.
But they're carrying a larger stress than the single women who do not have children.
That is correct.
And so the set of issues may be somewhat different, or maybe not. I don't know. I guess the question behind my question is, do you differentiate those two groups of women with different messages, or do you collect, you know, pull them together and say, here's one message for single women?
Well, we really pull them together because they're both economically stretched. But those women with children, there are two issues that do separate them out a little bit more, which is they feel their health care situation is not only bad for themselves, but obviously for their child. And then education, as you can imagine, having affordable education and quality education for their kids and actually also for themselves.
Yeah.
These women know that to get ahead, they need to get educated.
Well, and I would think that that would be an issue that could combine the two. But I could also envision a single woman hearing a conversation about, you know, child care, for example, or issues that have to do with children or child health care, just saying, you know, that's not me. That's not my issue.
You know, that's not actually true. It's very interesting. When we do our research and look at survey and focus group research, those issues about child care and being able to take care of your children, they resonate with all women.
Hmm. Interesting. So empathy, because they could be at one point or, you know, a mother. We're talking with Paige Gardner. She's the founder of Women's Voices, Women's Vote, WVWV.org. Paige, we just have a few seconds left. What are you doing right now, and how can people help?
Well, we're organizing for the 2008 elections. People can help by contacting us on our website, as you said, WVWV.org. And I would leave with one message, which is every woman out there should recognize that their voice is important, but their vote makes them listen.
Yeah.
So get out there and vote and participate.
Yeah. And participate before you vote, even. I mean, we need to get people, you know, writing letters to the editor and calling the members of Congress and joining organizations. Is there a MoveOn equivalent? I guess you're it, right?
That's right. I mean, we are trying to be. What we also try to do is partner with other organizations who are very active in advocacy, so they have many voices and many channels through which to express their voice.
That's great. Paige Gardner, she's the founder of Women's Voices, Women's Vote, WVWV.org, the website. Check it out. Paige, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C.
The Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
And not only did they lie, they destroyed their lies. 140,216 emails sent or received by Karl Rove alone have been systematically and intentionally destroyed by the Republican National Committee. This according to a new report out from the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, which has been investigating whether the White House officials violated the Presidential Records Act, which requires that this stuff be kept. And this is Rosemary Woods on steroids. I'm telling you, this is this organized crime syndicate called the Republican National Committee has destroyed so much. They're making sure they're not going to make the same mistake they made with Watergate. Christy Harvey is with us with Mike Check Radio and the Center for American Progress. And, hey, Christy, welcome.
Hey, thank you.
Great to have you here, and nice to meet you in person.
I know. It's sort of strange to put faces to voices, isn't it? I love that.
Especially after all this time. And what's your take on this?
I think it's, like you said, it's like the mafia. It is such a systematic bit of obstruction of justice, and the fact that they think that Alberto Gonzalez may have been in on this act also.
Yeah.
And he's the guy who's supposed to be in charge of, you know, maintaining
enforcing law.
Yeah. And I also love that they tried, this is what, their seventh or eighth excuse for why they can't hand these emails over. First there is no email trail. Then we lost the emails. Then it was, well, they're on the servers, we just can't download them. Then it was, well, we gave them to Patrick Fitzgerald. And now it turns out that was just a big stall so they could get in there and do some carpet bombing and get rid of all of the evidence.
Yeah, it's absolutely astounding. The RNC has preserved only 130 emails sent to Karl Rove during George Bush's first term, and no emails sent by Rove prior to November 2003. 130 emails. That's it. That's all they've saved.
I get that in the morning.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
If you're Carl Rove.
I get that in the first 3 hours of the day.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. It's incredible. Several federal agencies contacted by the committee have indicated that they, quote, have preserved official communications that were destroyed by the RNCs, but others have resisted the investigation. They're using private corporations to do... This is like... You know, the mob using front companies to do illegal waste, you know, where they're dumping toxic waste in neighborhoods and saying, oh, we're just oiling the roads, you know. Or
exactly.
This is incredible. And Gonzalez may have known about it.
Gonzalez was the guy in there helping to wipe the fingerprints off and drop the gun into the Hudson. I mean, that is exactly what's going on here. And they might get away with it if they've been smart enough and destructive enough and corrupt enough. They could get away with this if those emails are gone.
Yeah, well, that's why I said this is Rosemary Wood on steroids, because I think that 18 and a half minutes in that Nixon tape obviously contained something that was far more explosive than what caused Richard Nixon to resign.
Absolutely.
And it's been a long time since we've had a senior official charged with treason. In fact, I'm not sure it's ever happened. I'm thinking back to, you know, at least some of the debates between Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton. You know,
that's where my mind went to. That's
yeah,
kind of
exactly.
Funny.
the debate at gunpoint. But in any case, Christy, let's take a couple calls, too. Our toll-free number, 1-866-303-2270. Is that it, Chris? Am I remembering my own phone number right? This is the problem with having a little tag in front of you.
866-303-2270.
303-2270, 866. James, number 12 in Santa Fe. We had you on a few minutes ago, number 12, and I had to put you back on hold. I'm sorry. Welcome back.
That's fine. I have you on speed dial. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
I don't have your number memorized either. Hey, I'm glad you're calling from Washington, D.C., and I want to make I had a couple points, but I'm going to keep it down to one. I voted for Governor Bill Richardson, and I'm not a liberal. And there's two reasons why I voted for him, because he's a tax-cutting, pro-gun Democrat. And I'm so glad you're in Washington, D.C., because the recent Shelley Parker versus the D.C. Court of Appeals decision was upheld. And basically what it did is it struck down the D.C. gun ban based on Second Amendment individual right grounds, and the full court refused to rehear it. So they have to get rid of that thing or take it to the Supreme Court. And I'm glad that, of all places, the D.C. Court of Appeals recognize the Second Amendment as an individual right. That's all I need to say.
Okay. Well, you said it, and you said it well. Thanks a lot for the call. Let's see here. Robert in San Mateo, California. Hey, Robert, welcome to the program.
Yeah, Tom, hi. You had Robert Greenwald on here. That was great. I've seen some of his documentaries, The Social Work. It's very good. There are other documentarians. There's a gal who has a website, 911weknow.com, Sophia. And she spent probably $100,000 producing 9/11 mysteries and wants to make a trilogy involving the U.S. Air Force training exercises, Part 2, and the contractors. Who benefits from 9/11? And she needs help and funding. Of course, Robert Greenwald is a big company and a lot of financial backing. But somebody like that who's put, like Sophia, that's put a lot of money into a beautiful film. You should see it, 9/11 Mysteries. Have you seen it yet?
I have not. I have not, Robert. Well, and you know, thanks for sensitizing us to it. You know, I mentioned on the program, and Christy, you probably get this as well. I mentioned on the program a couple of days ago that we tried to put together a program about 9/11 where we wanted to get on the folks from Popular Mechanics or some variation, somebody who would take the position of the 9/11 Commission, and, you know, that it was just these guys with the box cutters or whatnot, and to get some representatives from the 9/11 truth community or what, you know, there's variations. And David, my producer, came on and said, you know, we couldn't find anybody who would come on and debate. First of all, we can't find anybody, nobody has contacted us, and we've contacted a number of them. You know, the magazine wouldn't do it. The other that would come on and take that position. And so to have somebody come on and say, oh, it's a controlled demolition, and not to have somebody on the other side say, no, wait a minute here, when, you know, it wouldn't be a discussion. It would just be that. And so anyhow, I mentioned that, and it's amazing. I've gotten several hundred emails over the last couple of days as a consequence of that. Many of them people saying, I'd be glad to come on, and
right.
I'd be glad to debate. All of them on the it's a conspiracy side of it, and I have some familiarity with conspiracy theory. Lamar Waldron and I spent 17 years writing a book about the Kennedy assassination, which is out now. It's called Ultimate Sacrifice, and what I saw in the Kennedy community was this fratricide, was, you know, all this sniping, and probably 10% of the emails that I got over the last couple of days that I've received have been of the nature of, I'll come on, but don't put so-and-so on, because so-and-so is full of BS, or so-and-so is a liar, or so-and-so. And I'm talking about so-and-sos within the 9/11 conspiracy community. And
friends of the conspiracy.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, and I consider myself a friend of the conspiracy to the extent that I am absolutely neutral on this. And I'm neutral because I went through this with the Kennedy assassination. I mean, when we started our investigation on that, we were assuming that probably the CIA or LBJ had something to do with it, and we discovered something completely different. But we rejected the Oswald single shooter theory, but had the evidence pointed in that direction, we would have, it was like, let's do an evidence-based research.
Right.
And this turned into what's nearly a 1,000-page book. It's a really pretty massive tome. I'm calling for, and have been, and consistently will continue to call for, serious investigation of this. And I'm really pleased to see a community forming, trying to find out not just, what happened with Buildings 1 and 2, but why did this happen?
Right.
Who was asleep at the switch? How many warnings did Bush get? Why did he ignore them? Isn't it these weird coincidences of Bush's failed oil company was funded by Osama bin Laden's brother. Another one of his brothers was having breakfast with his father the morning of 9/11. And these things that just make you scratch your head and like, what is going on? And so anyhow, I just want to put it out to that if anybody, I don't need any more emails telling me how terrible so-and-so is and, oh, that movie is a bad one, this movie is the good one, enough already. We got it. And B, if anybody still, I still say this, if anybody can get somebody from the there was no conspiracy, it was just these 19 guys with box cutters and it was all Osama bin Laden, if somebody can get somebody from that group to come on the program and debate with you, then let us know.
Well, I think that's the most interesting thing is there are so many questions.
Yeah.
And I've been sort of sucked in by some of the conspiracy theories, but none of the conspiracy theories match up with each other. Everybody wants to have the theory that doesn't go along with anything that anybody else has already said.
Yeah, well, I hadn't realized just until this last week how fractured the community is.
Here's the good news. If people keep sending you emails, you can just get Carl Rove in there to delete them for you.
There you go. Yeah. Indeed. Christy Harvey with us from the Center for American Progress and from MikeCheckRadio.com?
.org.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
44 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
And I'm taking my country back. Boys, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sold overseas. Now we owe billions to be rich Chinese. You blew the budget and you botched Iraq.
We're taking our country back, and we're here broadcasting live from the conference where it's all happening here in Washington, D.C., the ourfuture.org, the website. And we have a winner, by the way, in our I don't know if I want to call it a contest. It's really not. It's sort of our David giving away a book today here to one of the folks who was blogging. This was THANC, Thank. So congratulations, Thank, THANC. You are the winner for your post over at the blog, The Real Debate Issue, a.k.a. Nothing is Free. You said, why don't more people like the largely Republican-created national debt liken the largely Republican-created national debt to the U.S. having a giant credit card, granted a relatively low-interest card, used to pay for things it can't afford or could only afford if huge tax cuts weren't awarded to the rich? If it's true that the average family pays about $1,500 to $2,000 a year in taxes, a.k.a. interest-only payments toward repaying this debt, we're wasting money on many programs that are long gone and no longer benefiting us. The bottom line is that while conservatives are preaching low spending, fiscal conservatism, and personal responsibility, those three items are flushed down the toilet while they cut taxes while also borrowing money for which we must pay interest on a growing national balance. P.S. The $1,500 to $2,000 a year figure should be repeated over and over until the average Joe is aware of it. Democrats have done a poor job framing this issue by ignoring both use of analogy and the direct financial impact that people can relate to. Well said, thank, or however you pronounce T-H-A-N-C, and congratulations on being the winner of a copy of Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. We'll be getting that book out to you. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Nancy in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Nancy.
Oh, am I on the air?
You are on the air.
Okay. If I had only heard this morning, and maybe I missed something, it sounded hopeless about the Karl Rove emails. And, in fact, I'm sure you know about it. In fact, I might have heard it on your show that Greg Palast has, like, what, 510 of them that were mistakenly said to georgewbush.org instead
right.
of .com?
Yeah, he has 500 of them, but that's 500 out of hundreds of thousands.
Well, it sounded...
Probably millions, actually.
When I heard about the ones he had, it sounded as if he had something that was good to go and that was useful, and that John Conyers also thought so. So do you think those are useless and that this is a hopeless situation, or what's the deal?
Well, I don't think it's a hopeless situation. I think we're just beginning to discover what the situation is. A. B. I don't know how useful or useless the emails that Greg has may or may not be. I haven't seen them. He has been on this program talking about them. So the contents of some of them are in his last book.
Right.
Arm
it hurts page 207 or something.
Yeah, there you go.
But and when you all said, and they may get away with it.
Well, that was Christy who said that, yeah.
Yeah, so then I thought, well, then I wonder if they think that these are, that Greg Palast, that these aren't any good or whatever.
Well, I don't know. We're just going to have to see. But it's, I think that what has happened here, Nancy, is this is the Watergate moment. This is where it stopped just being a third-rate burglary, and it became something much larger. The question is whether the 18-minute gap is going to be enough to prevent the impeachment. You know,
I also heard Patrick Leahy saying something about he thought that they had a hard drive somewhere with a bunch of stuff. So does that mean that this is the same hard drive somebody went in for the delay and just erased it all?
What Leahy was saying is essentially conventional wisdom about anything that happens on the internet, and that is that, you know, nothing is ever erased. And you know, yeah, and at a certain level, you know, things exist on servers, and it is possible forensically to go back and pull them out and find that they're there. On the other hand, if they've been copied over enough times, or if that particular hard drive was upgraded and the physical drive itself was removed and only the new content on it, the post-deletion content, was transferred to a new drive, then no, they really and truly could be deleted. And so, Raj in Los Angeles, you think not?
Hello?
Hey, Raj.
Yes. No, Tom, I think you answered my question. This is the same question I had, you know, like high-tech guys, you know, top-of-the-line guys. They can, you know, because these emails, they will be in the cyberspace somewhere, you know, even if they are destroyed by the hardware. So these high-tech, you know, top-of-the-line guys, you know, they can retrieve these emails, and that's what the FBI...
Assuming that
crooks, you know, delete the emails.
No, I understand that, and I agree with you, assuming that the hardware still exists. But if the company goes in and says, okay, we're going to replace this 200-gigabyte hard drive with a 1,000-gigabyte hard drive, and we're only going to transfer data to the new hard drive, which is the hot data, the data that we're acknowledging exists in the old hard drive, and then we're going to take the old hard drive and we're going to crush it, you know, recycle it, take it apart, break it into pieces, you know, whatever, then that information really and truly is gone. And my guess is, since we're dealing with what is obviously an organized criminal institution, that they did it right. My guess is that they did it right, although, you know, like I said, time will tell and Congress will investigate, and let's hope that Congress can get to the bottom of it. Raj, thanks for the call. Robert in Los Angeles. Hey, Robert.
Hey, how you doing?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Hey, I was doing a little bit of reading over the weekend over the Constitution and looking at some Thomas Jefferson quotes, and I was hoping you could help me decipher a quote. And I'm going from memory, so bear with me. But he refers to the United States as the Tree of Liberty, how it's framed. And if for some reason...
From time to time, the Tree of Liberty must be watered by the blood of patriots. Is that the quote you're talking about?
Well, it's a little bit different than that, but I guess it goes to if the Tree of Liberty is hijacked, blood may be necessary, and that would be the manure to keep the tree growing. Mm. And I was wondering if you could decipher that for me.
Yeah. First of all, my recollection is that when Jefferson said that, he was speaking not of the American Revolution, but of the French Revolution. And that later in his life, he basically disavowed that statement. You know, a lot of Americans, I'd say probably the majority of Americans, thought when the French Revolution first started that it was going to be like the American Revolution and it was going to be a fine thing and they were going to overthrow, you know, the existing order and create a democracy. And instead, what happened was the French Revolution turned into Maximilian Robespierre and the Terror, you know, and the guillotine and all that kind of stuff. And in part, it's because France wasn't occupied by a foreign country, you know, like the United States was. We were occupied by the British. And and so, you know, we overthrew an occupying force and tossed them out. And you know, that didn't happen in France. And so that's my recollection of it. You know, on the other hand, if he was referring to the American Revolution, yeah, I mean, that's what happened. But in his later years, Jefferson was not anywhere near the advocate for violent revolution that he was in his early years. 57 minutes past the hour, broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference here in Washington, D.C. We'll be back at the conference tomorrow. And once again, broadcasting live from the conference, ourfuture.org, their website, tomhartman.com, and Air America Hours. See you tomorrow. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.